You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show,
Brian Keating, author of the excellent book, Losing the Nobel Prize. He's been on the podcast before, and we talked about all his amazing scientific achievements in his quest to actually see the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang. We describe that and talk about that in the podcast about his book, Losing the Nobel Prize. But in this particular episode, we were going to start talking about the 10 or a dozen possible ways the universe could have started, and we were going to do a deep dive and explain for everybody, take it from the complicated to the simple. But we just started riffing on different ideas and running different ideas by, and he has lots of projects that he's working on. So this basically is a fly on the wall view into the kind of conversation about ideas that I have on a regular basis with my friends and with people I work with. And we go through a lot of different ideas and possibilities in a very short amount of time. So hang on and enjoy the ride. Thanks.
So you hear me, James?
Yeah.
Okay. So another one I do with my kids sometimes, or did with my kids, my two older boys, 7 and 9. I said, you know, let's say you guys are in the kitchen. There's this enormous cookie. It's so delicious. It's got the M&Ms, it's got the frosting and the sprinkles. You both go to it and you grab it. And then you come to me and you say, Dad, I found it first. It's all mine. And Elijah, the younger one, says, no, it's all mine. I found it first. What should I do? And they always say, well, you know, I found it. I really did find it, or whatever. Or they'll say, all right, just split it in half. Okay. And that seems fair. And then I say, oh, that's great. Now let's say you're walking down the street and you find a lost puppy. And Elijah says he found it first. You say you found it first, Isaac. What do we do? Oh, wait a second. You know, what do we do now in that case? And that's the famous, you know, split the baby.
Yeah.
You know, King Solomon. But it's related to its a finding in the Talmud.
But also it's related to the Nash equilibrium, right?
Yes.
In game theory. So the answer, and again, the answer for me is, you know, always err on the side of giving.
Yes.
So that if by my actions other people have more abundance, then again, a rising tide lifts all boats. So
yes.
I would just automatically say he could have it.
And so
it's the same question of if you and your wife are prisoners and you're given the choice, who's going to die first? You would always say me, I would die first.
Right. Well, in the case of the puppy, you're actually supposed to sell it and split the money. So the Talmud rules that you split it, but you don't split the physical item. Obviously, you don't kill the baby, but you give it. So splitting the baby, that one went to the real mother, says to give it up because she loves it so much she doesn't want it to be killed, when Solomon says to split it. But you're right.
So my solution implies when you can't split it, but mm-hmm. Like in cases of a divorce, then it makes sense to sell it and split it. So like, for instance, this is, by the way, an easy way to do a divorce that I tell people, which is, you know, so it separates the emotions from the assets. So obviously, when you want a divorce, emotionally you want the divorce,
right?
And the assets are the only thing that's complicated. It's not like you have to like negotiate about how much you're going to be feeling for each other after
right.
this. So a very simple way to do a complicated divorce is put all of your assets into a company that you jointly own, with the agreement that you're going to work towards selling the company or all the assets in the company, and then you get emotionally divorced.
Right.
So that becomes a $1,000 divorce instead of a multi-million dollar, several-year divorce.
And actually, in the Talmud, there's much more, it's even more kind of fiscally oriented or financially structured, not to be, you know, pejorative, but so actually when you get married, the marriage contract is a prenuptial agreement, and it's written in Aramaic, and it says all the things the wife is entitled to during the marriage, including how many times she is entitled to have sex with her husband. It actually says that in there in Aramaic. And because there was a sliding
entitled
scale.
Entitled to or obligated to? That's
no,
an important
you
distinction.
Have to have, she's entitled to it. So if you don't fulfill her sexual needs, you are in violation of the Talmud. Now, you can't have sex for 2 weeks of every month because that is during her menstrual cycle. So that builds up a lot more. That's why Orthodox people have so many more kids than non-Reformed Jews because
But that's interesting, though, that they use the word entitled rather than obligated.
No, yeah. Yeah,
it's more centered around the mother because it's more centered around having children.
Yes.
And the mother wants the children and
more than
ostensibly
the father,
yeah. In this model, the man does not want as many children because then he has to make more money and
exactly
his life gets harder.
And depending on your profession, so this will interest you as it did me, depending on your profession, the number of times you are obligated to have sex with your wife, conversely, is dependent on your job. So actually, if you thought, which would have more obligation, a stonemason or a rabbi, a Talmudic scholar? Who has to have sex more often?
The stonemason, because the rabbi is supported by the community.
Well, that, but also because he's using his mind so much. And the Talmud considers physical labor subservient to this mental labor. And actually studying the Torah, deriving laws and implications, that's considered the most praiseworthy and strenuous of all activities. Obviously, they wrote it, right? So the rabbis, the priestly class, are the ones who wrote this document and had. But it's kind of goes against the normal priestly Genghis Khan, you know, notion where the powerful have the most number of kids. In this case, they're basically saying, oh, it's okay if we have fewer kids because we're going to focus our main effort psychologically. Sexual energy is going to be transmutated into intellectual energy, whereas a stonemason, you know, he's just cracking stones all day.
Well, what's so interesting is that the whole idea of that and the entitled versus obligated is almost like men in Judaism have reversed the whole traditional hierarchy of every other primate, where right. The alpha male, you know, and in Judaism, the leader is the rabbi.
Right.
But still they can't get away from the fact that ultimately the physically strongest person is the real alpha male.
That's right. Yeah, physically, yeah, they do need it. So there's a Nobel Prize winner wrote a couple of different things. One is called Risk Aversion in the Talmud. Another one's called Game Theory in the Talmud. This guy's Robert J. Aumann, A-U-M-A-N-N. I'll send you the articles. So yep. It goes through a couple of things. Like if you have a frequent thing that happens in law is proportional division. You have five kids. And how do you divide up each dollar of debt that you may owe after you're gone? So what's the obligation that that people have on your estate when there's multiple people? And it goes through the game theory matrix of the claimants versus the estate amount. It's just a cute little page. He didn't win the Nobel Prize for that, but he's an economist. So he went through, and he actually uses this really interesting. Are you going to have screen sharing on your new Zoom thing that you're doing?
Yeah, eventually.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. It's not super, I wouldn't wait to roll that out, but it's kind of cool. So he actually goes through and shows using the laws of fluid dynamics that there's actually a way to make a physical analog using pumps and pistons to how you divide up unequal claims. And the claims are kind of the throttle size of a throat between two pistons or two cylinders. And then if you have equal amounts, then they're equal pistons. So he has this fluid flow analysis. He's a very creative guy. I think he's still alive.
You know, what's interesting about that is I like when multiple, I think this is the key to life really, is when multiple domains combine to create something better. So in his model, if you can use that to forward predict something that wasn't previously predictable or forward take an action that wasn't previously thought wise, then I think that's very interesting.
Yeah, it's like law plus physics, you know, kind
like,
of
together. Like I was reading one of these about one of the things, I think, I forget if it was the quantum loop gravity one, and there was some reference to category theory, which is kind of like group theory, but even a little bit more abstract.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually, the one academic paper I've ever written was about category theory.
Oh, really?
And,
oh, wow.
And I was going to write a second one about how you can model AI with category theory. And I showed my ideas to this one category theoretician and this one AI professor, and they ended up taking the idea and writing a paper about it without me.
Oh, great.
Which is fine.
Yeah.
Like, I always learn.
It's a risk, yeah.
Yeah, but, and I was fine with that, but it was just, you know, that was an example. No one had thought to use this obscure branch of mathematics to define AI.
Maybe we'll do a podcast on my show about that because, I'm getting into a lot more AI and physics and can you have an AI Galileo? You know, is there a way, or is it fundamentally different domain, in physics versus the creative process? Like, you can have AI art, but that's really just machine learning and what A/B testing on a huge number of samples. But physics is different because there's an objective truth, unlike art where it's all subjective, and you can get statistically. You know, it's no way to say, oh, statistically, what do most people think about quantum gravity? Like, it's irrelevant.
So you absolutely can't have AI.
AI Galileo. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the reason is because every mathematical theory can be encoded into the Lambda calculus, which is, in a sense, a programming language, mm-hmm. right? That's the every Lambda calculus expression is a programming language. And if you can do AI to solve Lambda calculus equations, which you more or less can, then essentially everything that's provable can be done via AI.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. So yeah, let's make that a topic for
You can generate theories using the just regular deep learning that's happening now.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, exactly. There is a guy at MIT named Max Tegmark who has this campaign for artificial. But really what he's doing is he's encoding existing laws, like known laws of physics, into machine learning and just saying, like, would you get a parabola out? Like, can you get Newton's laws out of data? But this is something different. This is like, you know, would you predict the positron, you know, from first principles if you had no other, because it's so different. It almost doesn't fit into the existing framework of mathematics or physics. Like, Dirac had to add this extra concept called a spinner that, you know, no matter how much random, you know, monkeys throwing darts at a dartboard, you'd never come up with that because it's actually like, you know, what if it's like the 52nd dimension has these certain properties, but every other dimension out of the infinity of possible dimensions doesn't have it. But, you know, he just tried it, and he had some intuition guided by, yeah, group theory essentially. And now all of modern particle physics is based on that. So
I'd have to, that sounds interesting. I'd have to see a little more how he was using the group theory. But like something like the positron, let's say there was no mathematical basis for it. So it would be hard to derive from first principles, but you could still look at the history of creativity and say, okay, for every idea, let's try to invert it and prove it.
Yeah.
And so the electron inverted would be the positron, right? So
yeah, that's charge reversal symmetry. That's right.
Yeah. So if I say like, I want to use AI to make, let's say there's a country with no, they just got the internet introduced, and now I want to use AI to become a billionaire. I can say, well, okay, in America, Google, a search engine got big, so let's make a search engine in this weird country with this weird language.
Right.
And so that's how, without first principles, you could use corresponding creativity to.
Right.
You could have a theory of creativity.
So it's interesting. I read this. I'm reading this dialogue on Two World Systems by Galileo, and I came across this passage yesterday. I want you to tell me if this reminds you of anything as it did with me. So he's talking about people that are really smart versus people that are stupid. He says, the vain presumption of understanding everything can have no other basis than never understanding anything. For anyone who has experienced just once the perfect understanding of one single thing and had truly tasted how knowledge is accomplished would recognize that of the infinity of other truths, he understands nothing.
That is a great paragraph from Galileo.
Yeah, that's this book, James, is so deep. And so this is, I think it's like the Dunning-Kruger effect, or Kruger, whatever it's called, Dunning-Kruger effect.
Yeah.
Because he's saying like the little you know makes you think you know a lot, that you understand something or even everything. That if you apply that, you realize that you actually understand nothing, but you have this taste of confidence that you understand everything because you understood something.
Yeah, like you know, and I've talked about this on a podcast before, which is that everybody assumes the Dunning-Kruger effect is this laughable negative thing, like that's Dr. Altucher, he's got the Dunning-Kruger effect,
right?
But the reality is, I would never have done anything in my life without a powerful Dunning-Kruger effect.
Bias, like, yeah.
You know, you can't become, for instance, a novelist without the Dunning-Kruger effect because your first novel's always going to be shit.
Right.
But you're going to think it's great, so that's going to keep you going. No one understands me.
That's right.
And comedy. You will never go up comedy, stand-up comedy, more than 3 or 4 times without the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'm funny. It's just that
it's really underrated. It's really underrated, right?
You know, it almost makes me think, this is an article idea too, but I have a chapter in my next book called the Science of Idea Calculus or the Math of Idea Calculus. Mm. And I basically I basically map creativity onto, you know, everything from, you know, calculus to addition, division, multiplication, subtraction, and talk about how you could generate ideas, you know, applying math to creativity.
Mm.
So, you know, adding two ideas together or subtracting an idea from another idea. You know, like for instance, what's comedy? Comedy is drama where you subtract skills. So for instance, if I'm Bruce Willis and a bunch of terrorists are coming into the room, I have this skill where I'm going to pull out like 17 guns and shoot everybody and do karate and so on. But if I'm Woody Allen, so I'm removing the skill of being able to use weapons and having any physical dexterity at all. If a bunch of terrorists come in on Woody Allen, comedy will result if he tries to do the same thing as Bruce Willis. So that's idea subtraction.
Yeah, like Home Alone, right? So yeah, if like Kevin's this, you know, sniper in the movie and just like assassinates the guys right as they come in, the first, like the movie's over, there's no comedy.
Right,
exactly. But because he doesn't have that, he has to improvise comedic skills that are tangential to the actual skills that a Bruce Willis character would need. Yeah, that's really funny. That's a good one. But the reason I bring up the Galileo thing is, so this is a book idea. So Galileo obviously wrote the book. There's a Kindle version, but there's no Audible version. And this book is so readable. It's at the forwards by Einstein. He called it the most important book in history, basically. The other person is this guy, Stephen Jay Gould at Harvard. So it's like the best science writers in history and you know, have basically blessed this book, and it doesn't have an audiobook. And so,
that's so interesting.
I'm wondering, like, how do we go about like making it into, because it's so readable. He has, I mean, there's just a couple of, you know, it's structured in this Platonic thing, but it's up to date. You know, he did Idea Sex with Copernicus and Plato, you know, separated by 2,000 years, and just really trying to, and he was full of biases, and you know, it's almost like worthy of a psychological study of, you know, the Dunning-Kruger effect, the confirmation bias effect, because originally he wanted to call it a study on the flux and reflux of the Earth's tides, which is the one element of this book that's completely wrong. The rest of it's correct. Obviously, the sun is not going around the Earth, but the tides don't prove that. He said that the Earth going around the sun, as it rotates on its axis and as it moves in its orbit, causes a sloshing effect like the water in this water bottle. That was his analog. But it has the real tides on the ocean have nothing to do with that. It's all due to the moon's influence on the Earth.
Right.
So he spends a lot of time proving that the moon is just like the Earth, and of course, it's full of intrigue because it's related to, you know, how he got imprisoned and he insulted the Pope, who was once his best friend.
So it's just thinking how to do this. Like,
yeah,
it's all public domain, so you don't need any permissions.
What about the translation, though? I mean, I'm reading a translation by this guy who's also dead, this guy Stillman Drake. In my book, I printed pictures from it, and I just said, you know, oh, it's public domain, which it is, but you can't just like go to Getty Images and take a picture of it. So how do you get around that? The fact that it's
Translation is not public domain, right? So so like for instance, Wayne Dyer once did a book about the Tao Te Ching, it's one of his best selling books. It turns out it was based on a translation by Stephen Mitchell, so Stephen Mitchell sued him, and Stephen Mitchell's married to another big self-help writer. So it's funny, just all these self-help writers about, you know, personal empowerment are all suing each other.
Like but conniving.
What you can do is, though, I wonder if there's any public domain translations, or if you use Google Translate and fix it up yourself, you know, so you translate it effectively using the help of Google Translate, and you could kind of match, you know, just to make sure you're on track, you can match what you're doing with other translations, make sure you're translating correctly. You could just make the translation, And then what I would do is I would hire a professional reader to read the Galileo parts, but then every other chapter would be you commenting, you know, with all of these observations like Dunning-Kruger, or this is what he's saying to avoid the church, or this is, you know, idea, whatever. And I would totally do that because audiobooks, by the way, sell more than every other kind of book right
now. Yeah, I know. Yeah, they're like super podcast. I mean, this is 500 pages long. The other idea I had is like get someone who's Italian. He sat there in the studio and read it, and he has a good English, you know, American accent, so that's fine. I mean, he's Italian, but, you know, that at least makes it a little more plausible, even though he's just reading from this guy's... I mean, the guy who wrote it, who did the translation, is dead, but, you know...
But his estate will own the... I mean, I don't know all the exact cutoffs when he doesn't... Like, it's 60 years or something like that.
Yeah, it's so, not that long. It's close, actually.
So, but I would just... translate it somehow or use Fiverr, like Fiverr.com.
Yeah, I know them, Oh, wait, James. Actually, there's an original. So he translated it from a 1911 translation, which was translated from a 1750 translation. I mean, there are a lot of English translations that are hundreds of years old.
So, So I would take one of those public domain translations and just modernize the language and then you're done.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Because those are public domain.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I don't want to do it. I don't have 20 hours to sit in a booth, you know, and read the thing. But
but that's where this is what's great about this. It's not your book. It's Galileo. So just get a professional reader for that part. But I would do.
Oh, the intermediate chapters. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you could just riff even. You don't even have to have like a scripted or written version.
Right. Yeah. That's actually very interesting. Yeah. And it also adds value to the existing written book, which is always a bestseller, right? So like, Peter Diamandis always audiobook narrates his books, with his co-author Cutler. And then they have these intermediate riffing chapters between each actual printed chapter. So you get actual extra value from the audiobook as compared to the written book.
Yeah. And, when I did the audiobook for Choose Yourself, I did it totally riffed. Like I stuck to the basic outline and then I would just riff new stories and extra stories and stuff like that. Because then it's like a completely separate product.
Yeah.
So people would have to buy both.
Right.
But with this Galileo one, there's so much fuel in what I call this spoken wheel model of, you know, one idea is the wheel, but then you generate lots of spokes at it. You could get that. That's fuel for TED Talks, for corporate
calendar, like daily.
A calendar, corporate consulting, or corporate business talks, like the Galileo method of creativity. Yep. And you're going to train, you know, everybody to think like a Galileo.
Yep.
And you go into corporations for $150,000 for a weekend boot camp.
Yeah.
You could do a podcast series, one chapter per one episode per chapter.
Yeah.
So there's lots of different things that could spin out of that.
I think so. Yeah. We didn't finish off the Talmud idea. So, I'm just debating right now. So one thing I'd like to do personally. So I don't know, Jay, are you recording? I forgot.
He is, but this is not
fine.
Jay,
so
you'll stop.
I'll just say, I don't
need to use this for anything.
No, it's fine. No, we should use this because we had a lot of good ideas. It'd be fun to get paid to actually do this instead of, you know, like spending $10,000 thanks to Jay's advice about microphones, mixers, sound machines, cloud lifters. Okay. Anyway, I'd like to be at least not so negative, but I would like to have the satisfaction of putting stuff out. You know, it's like my book sold 10,000 copies maybe, you know, which is not bad for, especially
No, it's great.
Yeah. And audiobook more, you know, probably 20,000 total units.
A book about losing the Nobel Prize is not going to be Harry Potter.
Yeah.
So you have different metrics for success, but still, you know, copies and money are ways to measure if you did a good job.
Mm-hmm.
If you did the job you wanted to do.
Which is what exactly. So, I mean, I measure that also by like how many emails do I get from someone in Pakistan, you know, writing an Orthodox, you know, practicing Jew, you know, about how much it changed, you know, her life. You know, she's like, she's a devout Muslim and she wants to be on my podcast. She wants to be on her, you know, it's funny how those little Ugandans write me all the time. But anyway, the question I have is like, yes, we could do this 30-day book on the Talmud, but I almost feel like, yeah, there's still the prestige of publishing with a publisher, but I'd need it to be easy because I don't have the time. I'm doing the Simons Observatory. I'm trying to, you know, I think the book that you and I are talking about, definitely 30-day book, or, you know, whatever, Amazon self-published, we got to do it that way. And that'll be a dream, you know, to do that with you. But the Talmud book, I think, it could fulfill one of my other desires in life, which is to be like a unique kind of lecturer that can talk not just about like business. I think there's too many, but like ethics and morality and just like, how do you treat people? Like one thing that in the Talmud, it's, and actually comes from the Torah itself. If you say that I killed somebody, but you lied, then you get put to death. In other words, you get the punishment. So it's a game theory. There's so much game theory in the Torah, and there's so much science in the Torah.
As well as, you know, a basis for law. Like a lot of times, with a lot of these religions, people think of them as they're supposed to be spiritual and religious, and there's the separation of church and state.
Right.
But actually, things like the Tao Te Ching might not have been spiritual or religious at all. It might have just been a political guidebook.
Yeah.
Just like the Talmud might have just been, you know, or at least partly a political guidelines of how to be a leader and how to be a citizen.
So one of my goals with this book would be in the Talmud book, you know, how it's relevant to your life today is to like, you know, I'd like to be able to go to Israel and give speeches in yeshivas and also talk in America, you know, at yeshivas without becoming a rabbi. You know, I don't want to do that. I'm not that nutty about it. But like, which do you think would have a higher impact? Publishing, you know, traditional publisher or, you know, 30-day book, we get it out, we could do it. I'm also thinking of like, you write the foreword to it, Ben Shapiro write the foreword, you know, we have like 10 forewords, Dennis Prager write the afterword. But do you think that works better in a traditionally published book? I have nothing against the traditionally published book. And seeing as you and I are going to do a self-published one, do you think I need it?
Here's the way I would do it. Mm-hmm. I would, I don't think it matters. I think the only thing that matters is quality. Mm-hmm. So do what I call a professionally self-published book. So as opposed to, you know, just talking it out and then the transcript and we'll make this beginning of the universe book as high quality as possible.
Yeah.
But like with this one, it could be really well thought out. It could be, I mean, I'm not saying one's not thought out and the other is, but it doesn't have to be in 30 days. Like just plan it out the way you would want to do it. Don't, you know, it's a quality idea. Mm-hmm. The benefit of a traditional publisher, let's say there's two benefits now. And they're not monetary and they're not marketing. And I'm gonna say they're not stigma related because that doesn't really matter anymore. Yeah. But the benefits are you get in bookstores, but that's not as relevant right now.
Yeah.
And the other benefit is that you get in advance. So the third component, which is stigma, I'm not so sure stigma exists. Like I think an older generation of writers will say that stigma exists, but nobody cares at all right now.
Yeah.
Like how many people have asked you, hey, who is your publisher, by the way?
Right. Yeah. No, they don't. I mean, people put it in, like it never got reviewed in the New York Times anyway. So, and I assume—
Which most books don't.
Yeah.
Most books published by traditional or self-published sell 100 copies.
Yeah.
So, and in on average, the average self-published book sells more copies than the average mainstream traditional published book. Now that was data from a few years ago, but I don't know if it's still true, but it is. And by the way, the average self-published book also, according to the same data from a few years ago, has a higher star ranking on Amazon than—
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I remember you saying that. So yeah, I mean, there's almost no advantage and it takes a lot shorter amount of time. You can get it out there much quicker with this approach.
Yeah. And you could use a service like Scribe Media, like Tucker Max's Scribe Media to get like a professional cover designer, some marketing help, a professional, you know, you need a professional interior designer. You need two editors, one who's really good at editing structure and the other who's good at, you know, grammar and line by line editing.
Mm-hmm.
So
I have a couple editors already from Norton that are just freelance, you know, cause they all get furloughed. So now I know like five great copy editors.
And then you do an audiobook, you do an ebook, you do a hardcover, you do a paperback, like all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And then you make up like,
Big Bang Publishing. Know, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's good. That's fine. And no one ever asked, like, you know, there's a lot of books. Actually, I think it's the Nobel Peace Prize Committee or something is doing a book through Scribe Media right now, as opposed to a traditional publisher.
Can you put me in touch with him and maybe Tim Ferriss, if you think that's a good idea? I was going to ask Noah, but I just feel like, you know, rather just kind of be his friend and not like ask him for stuff. Because I know Eric Weinstein, he always gets asked, and I asked him too, to put me in touch with Peter Thiel and with Joe Rogan. And he's just like, well, he said he would put me in touch with Rogan when the time is right. But, you know, I feel like you know, the time has never been more right. So I actually had the booking agent. I was friendly with the booking agent for Rogan a couple of months, about a year ago. And I never really pursued it because I was just like, I don't know if I want to get so big. But now I'm thinking to skip the, like, I just hit 10,000 subscribers. And I'm like, that would be like the ultimate skip the line, right? Just go on Rogan, go on Ferris. And every subscriber I get is like fighting a miniature skirmish, you know, for attention. Yeah. And I hate it.
I mean,
it.
You look at like Ryan Holiday, yeah. Who's an excellent.
He's going to come on my show in a couple, after his book comes out.
Oh, good. Yeah.
I got Seth Godin. I got him. I got, now I have Nobel Prize winners asking me to come on my show, which is cool.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
And Ryan, he doesn't have a podcast, yeah. And he always just markets his book by going on the best podcast out there. That's the best way to market a book right now.
Yeah. So, but then there's the one other book I have, which is based on, so this is the way that like Tim Ferriss might be able to help me. So on my podcast, I always ask people, you know, basically stuff specific about them, their book, their career. But I also ask like three questions at the end, the most important of which is like, what would you put in your ethical will? Not your monetary will, not what you're going to leave to your kids, but what do you want to leave to humanity as a guideline, you know, as you know, kind of like what Tim did with the billboard. But I think it's a little bit more nuanced the way I do it with like a monolith floating on a space asteroid or something, you know, a little bit more tangible. And so the thing I'm wondering about from Tim is, so I'd like to take all those conversations, Jim Simons, you, you know, these the women who lost the Nobel Prize for discovering pulsars, you know, get all these great women, Carl Sagan's widow, and men, and put them and have a book and just have what is their ethical will? Like, what do they want to leave?
Oh, yeah.
And like have that. The first chapter be like an introduction, like a little bit of a Jewish kind of spin to it. Like what the ethical will is comes from, you know, Jacob and the Talmud and the Torah rather, and Moses and the Deuteronomy, et cetera. And just kind of like frame it, but why it's so important. And here's a list of people I didn't interview, Barack Obama, you know, Oprah Winfrey, you know, just kind of name recognition, whatever. So it's kind of like this book by David Brooks called The Road to Character. And he talks about like there's two different versions of the creation story in the Bible. And this famous rabbi named Soloveitchik said that it represents two different aspects of a human being. Like Adam, the first human ever created, he works the soil, but he also communicates directly with God. So this rabbi called it like resume virtues, like what I've done, you know, to work the soil and name the animals and like all the productive daily work, you know, what college I went to. And then there's the ethical the eulogy virtues, which are much more important. Like he was a good man. He was a kind soul. He was a good, that's the thing that matters most, right? So if your kid isn't good at sports or she's not pretty, you say, oh, at least she has good character. But that's like the most important thing. Like I'd rather have my kid be great character than be the captain of the football team. So people don't think about this on a daily basis. And I actually think this might appeal to Tim that by thinking about like, if you wrote your will today, I claim it would make you less likely to commit suicide. If you have some suicidal ideation, if you just wrote your will and include your ethical will, what you lived for, what you stood for, what were the most pivotal moments in your life, what you overcame, I think, you know, it's almost like self-evident that it would make investing your life with more meaning. So there's a stealth component to writing your will. So the end of it would be how to write your ethical will and lessons learned from Jim Simons, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, kind of an intro, a conclusion, appendix, how to write your ethical will, a website to help you do it.
And yeah, you could even store it, quote unquote.
Yeah. Yeah. I put it in a time capsule, like on the internet.
So,
right.
So I find that what's very interesting, what you're doing is, this is Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, mm-hmm. but a much more practical.
I only like the second half of that book. I only like the like gestalt therapy. I don't even care about the concept. I'm joking.
You've seen like, yes, I don't like the second half.
I know. I'm teasing you.
because by the way, he doesn't really give a practical way of getting there.
You're absolutely
and,
right.
And so what I like about your idea is you're kind of giving a practical way to mm-hmm. get there, and you're giving also a more practical reason for getting there. Mm-hmm. I mean, his reason also was extremely practical.
Yeah, of course.
But you're connecting the dots much more directly, which is interesting. And then you could also have some scientific research about what mm-hmm. it means what effect does it have on you to just write a will?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
J-Store,
does it actually?
Right, JSTOR.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm. and you know, and then Brad Meltzer has done some stuff. He did a TED talk on what's it like to write your own obituary. Mm-hmm. And it'd be interesting to talk to someone like that as well.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
And Brad Meltzer's a big thriller writer.
Oh, yes, I've heard that. Right. Yeah, okay, great. So that book, do you think would be better self-published again? Or, I mean, it would be nice to have, you know, the way to sell your nth book is to write your n plus two books, right? So, I mean, is there a way to, you know, just publishing self-published versus that for a book like this about character, you know, virtue, a little bit higher level?
Well, there's a couple of answers. One is when you self-publish, it doesn't mean you're not going to regularly publish. So a lot of self-published books, including 50 Shades of Grey, mm-hmm. The Martian, many nonfiction, yeah, yeah. But the Power of Now,
yeah.
Were all self-published. And then later on, major publishers published them when they were successfully self-published.
Interesting.
So one doesn't necessarily for the other. The other thing is, though, I see what you're saying. So despite my argument that there's no stigma, there is a little bit of feeling.
For an academic, especially. I mean, it's,
yeah. So what I do is, because I agree, is that I'll self-publish a bunch of books. And then I'll traditionally publish. Mm-hmm. So right now, my next book is going to be traditionally published. I haven't done that since 2015, maybe. Yeah. And, you know, just every few years, because I want to send the message that, hey, I'm still
legit.
I'm not as far afield as people think. I have my mainstream points as well.
Right.
I'll traditionally publish. So it's more of a signaling thing. Mm-hmm. And
There's something wrong.
In terms of getting excited about an idea and doing it, that I definitely say self-publish.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and then
great, and then
it's more of a pacing thing as opposed to the quality of the idea. Like all of these ideas could be mainstream published.
Yeah.
But it's more like I think to myself, you know, I don't want to wait a year and a half for this to come out.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be bogged down with writing a proposal and pitching it around to 20 publishers and, you know, having a bidding war and then going through their whole process. Sometimes I do want to do that. Sometimes I don't. But everything you can do, you could do through a hybrid like Scribe Media.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, that would be good to. And you mentioned Suzanne Gluck, your current, I guess she was your current agent, right?
Yeah.
It sounds like she did it. She basically made it, you know, as effortless as possible. And for your traditionally published book, almost like it was a self-published book.
Yeah, I mean, the way I don't feel like it's self-published is that the time frame.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular editor that I'm working with is really great. I've worked with her on another book in the past in 2011. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was really happy to work with her again, but she's an editor at HarperCollins.
Yeah.
So it all worked out. But the difficult part for me, which is like all the getting together a proposal, mm-hmm. setting up the meetings, Suzanne was amazing and took care of all of that. But like certainly my next book, well, actually, so my I pitched a new book already. And I do have to write it up a little bit more probably this weekend.
Uh-huh.
And then Suzanne and hopefully Harper will. Suzanne, I know, likes it. I know my editor likes it. I don't know yet mm-hmm. about publishers. But I'm also fine self-publishing it. So I can go, it doesn't matter to me. I can go either way. So like my next few books, it doesn't really matter to me because I'm doing this one.
Mm-hmm.
So
I mean, the main thing is just that you're writing and you're not stopping and you're doing a book. And then, yeah, what channel the book ends up in is almost irrelevant, right? It's not going to be less quality, right?
I think it's the great Ryan Holiday who told me you have three choices with a book, but you can't get all of them. Maybe it's one of these things you get two out of three.
Mm-hmm.
So you could sell a lot of copies. You could make a lot of money. Or you can get on a bestseller list.
Right.
So, but it's unlikely to get all three.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, like, unless it's like Harry Potter or Freakonomics or whatever. But like, choose yourself. I kind of almost did all three, and that was self-published.
Yeah.
So I didn't make the New York Times bestseller list because they had a rule against self-published.
Yeah.
I don't know if they still have that rule.
But
I made the Wall Street Journal and the USA Today list.
Yeah.
And sold a lot of copies and made money.
And helped a lot of people.
Yeah, so like maybe I could have sold more traditionally published or maybe it would have sold less. I don't know.
Did people come to you afterwards to publish it traditionally?
Yes.
They did, okay.
Yeah, but they wanted me to unpublish it, which I did not want to do.
Right, because you'd make
So I made a lot more. Well, like what ultimately happened is that Choose Yourself, the book, gave me a lot more opportunities outside of publishing
mm-hmm.
that have made me a lot more money.
Right.
So I didn't want to unpublish it.
And you could do a 10-year anniversary edition soon, you know. And
yeah, right. Mm-hmm. I thought about that actually for this next book coming up, but I had so many new ideas anyway that I just made it a whole new book.
Yeah, you could just do a new foreword for Choose Yourself and do it traditional or whatever.
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours. And they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop. Really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. So you're thinking of, with the Talmud one, to work on it with the Harvard guy and potentially self-publish. And you just need like maybe like some special number, like maybe 18 things. So it's 18 has that Jewish feel.
Yeah.
And then you have your commentary in there, or maybe it's just, you know, he writes his thing and then you have a discussion as like an addendum for each chapter.
Well, it'll start off like, because I want it to be funny. I want it to be funny. So it'll start off like this. You know, for example, with the person who tried to get you arrested for murder, that the quote would start, the chapter would start like this, you know, whatever, dying to convict or something would be the title. if an evil witness arises against a man to testify against him, and the judges investigate the matter and find that, lo, his testimony is a lie, then shall ye do unto him as he plotted to do unto his brother, and eradicate evil from your midst. Deuteronomy 19. So it'll start off like this really abstract, and you're like, what does this have to do? Like, eradicate evil to his brother? What are you even talking about? So it says, and then the law is actually from the, you know, if in Jewish law, a perjurer is treated exactly like the person against whom he testified would have been treated had the perjury not been discovered. And then you go through it, like, here's a case, you know, whatever, O.J. Simpson, or it could have some like modern relevancy. You know, I don't want to make it political at all, but I'm going to. So it'll have some, it'll start off with this like abstract, kind of thought-provoking, like, if ye neighbor's ox or ass, because you have to use ass as much as possible. If ye neighbor's ass escaped yesterday and the day before, and it shall gore a man, you know, or shall gore a woman and she shall miscarry, you know, then the owner shall pay damages, but the ox will not be put to death. And you're like, what the fuck? You know, like, what does this have? But then you translate it like, you know, replace the word ox with, you know, Volkswagen rabbit and replace, you know, or whatever. Replace it with Volkswagen and replace, you know, whatever with goring with like, you know, hit and run or whatever. And like, so you translate it into modern from the ancient and then come back. And the main thing is to make people think ethically. The Talmud's actually like a checklist, like the checklist manifesto. It's how you, like you said, it's all these areas of daily life. So there's going to be like five sections in each, or six sections, each with three chapters. So it'll be like, it'll have no reference to God. Like it will not mention God at all. It'll be totally for Christians, for Jews. So it'll start off with a line from the Talmud, something contemporary, vignette, an explanation of how it's commented today. And it will have the following chapters, like personal, financial, like interest, loans, shopping, that shopkeeper law, the Starbucks challenge. Like I might have Noah write a guest section, you know, on the Starbucks challenge, you know, like a response. Cause that's actually how the Talmud is written. It's like chess partners. Like you get better if you have a plus, a minus, and an equal.
Right. So you made me think of a bunch of structural ideas for this.
Awesome.
So
you're going to write the foreword though, right?
Yeah. I'll write the foreword.
I don't want you to have to like write the whole book, but I want you to write the foreword. Yeah.
But what I like here is whenever you've presented one of these things to me, you always do it in the form of a question that you want an answer for.
Yes.
So, or that you want me to answer. And I would structure each. The first thing I would have is a real world question that is going to be solved. And then you go from the real world question presented in, of course, modern language to the exact section of like Deuteronomy that's going to be interpreted. And then you maybe have the Talmud, just straightforward, the Talmud interpretation. And then you have the guy kind of really give the well thought out answer to the question using the Talmud interpretation and the Torah. And then if you're throwing an addendum on top of that, then you have that. And then you might even, then you can make a website or have a newsletter, a question per day or a question per week.
Okay,
you know, sign up for this and you're going to get a question per week that, you know, somebody different each week will answer.
Interesting.
And also you can have people submit questions and answers. So then you get the rabbinical community or the, you know, maybe even other religions.
Yeah, they have that, but nobody knows about it who's not Orthodox, who don't need it. You know, it's like Greg Zuckerman he'll talk to his rabbi. His rabbi has a newsletter, which he doesn't monetize.
But you know, I've seen those. And I almost think they border on, and I'm not saying anything insulting to anyone in particular, but they almost border on what I see when I see a pseudo-intellectual. Like they use big vocabulary when they could use little vocabulary. So like whenever I see one of those things, they're always using so many, I can't understand them because they're using like so many like, you know, Hebrew and Yiddish terms and terms from the Bible that I can't understand it. So it's like I lose interest, even though the questions might be interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, you can't get entry into it, right? Yeah.
So I see this structurally is very interesting, and also as spokes and wheel, there's website, newsletter, and then, by the way, I know like the public speaking thing is not as much interest, but you take anyone who writes any book peripherally related to Judaism, and there is nonstop public speaking.
Oh yeah, you never meet a Jew, or someone never meets a Jew and says, "Oh, that's great." You know, it's like, it's always like something interesting about a
but
Jew.
But like A.J. Jacobs wrote The Year of Living Biblically, and it's just kind of a humorous book, but it's his study of the Bible in a very funny but Jewish fashion.
Yeah,
and he is still giving talks off of that.
Yeah.
And same with Stephen Dubner, who obviously gives more talks on Freakonomics, but his very first book was called Turbulent Souls, about essentially realizing he was Jewish as an adult. His parents had converted to Catholicism when he was a little kid. And so he still gets speaking gigs off of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that I actually love speaking, and I love speaking and getting paid for it. It's just not, you know, it's like you always say, like, you have to balance this against saying to your four-year-old, you know, daddy has to go away. Like, how much is that worth, you know, for a weekend to go to Pacoima, you know, versus like standing there but you know, I do want to do it, and who knows when that'll happen again. I mean, if we could do it by Zoom, and that would be great. But the main thing is to get that, there's a certain level of, like, I would like to be the scholar in residence at synagogues and go and speak. Like Dennis Prager, he's got a great model. He's got a tremendous number of spokes and wheels, and I'm actually doing another one of the Prager universities for him. And I pitched you for Choose Yourself as a Prager. I mean, those get millions and millions of views. It doesn't translate into like book sales or invitations, but it's like very satisfying intellectually to get, you know, even a dollar for a mental idea that cost you $0, you know, it's just some calories that you had for breakfast, and it becomes an idea. And then my kids, you know, they think of me now, they're like, wow, you've got more subscribers, you know, and you've got more books sold. And like my middle son wants to write a book called Losing the Nobel Prize Part 2. You know, he's just like,
son of losing the Nobel Prize.
Return of the losing of the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
So some of the chapters, I'll just finish, some of the, so there's five major sections: family and friends, you know, interpersonal issues, children, splitting the baby, marriage. There's a very important concept in Judaism called Lashon Hara, which means evil tongue, which just means gossip. And, you're not even allowed to say something true about somebody, you know, if it's not, if there's a possibility it could redound to their detriment. In other words, I can't say, James is just like the greatest speaker in human history. He is amazing. And he's got his great TED talk, and he's just foundational. He's changed my life. And then someone says, he's not that great. He's kind of an asshole. Like, you won't know about it. You'll never know that I said this. It's like third party praise. I heard this on your show too. It's like, that's the most powerful type of praise. If I say, James, you should know something. Jay is the freaking best fucking engineer. That's so much better than me saying, Jay, you did
it's going to his head right now.
Oh, I don't know. Oh, he's listening? I didn't even know that. So there's all these laws about how you conduct your speech and what the punishment should be. There's a famous parable, like this guy says something negative about his rabbi. Then he goes to apologize to the rabbi, but it's actually true. It's like the rabbi had a marriage before he was married to his current wife. So that's a true fact. But there's nothing beneficial. It just feels good to share a juicy piece of gossip, especially when it's true. Yeah. And then he goes to the rabbi, how can I make it up to you? The rabbi says, it's very simple. You can make it up to me in the following way. Go to your house, get your pillow, and bring it here. And the guy's like, I'll do anything. I feel so guilty. It's Yom Kippur. Please tell me. I'll bring my pillow. The rabbi says, okay, bring the pillow. He brings the pillow. The guy says, what do I do now? The rabbi says, take a knife and cut the pillow open and shake the pillow. And the guy's like, oh, it's my favorite pillow, but fine. If this will make it right, I'll do it. Cuts the pillow open, shakes it. The wind comes by. The rabbi says, now go pick up every feather, and that will be your recompense to me. And meaning that, like, you don't ever know the outcome of the detrimental effects that it could have, the ripple effects of what you do, and therefore avoid it at first by not doing it in the first place, even if it's true.
So that's interesting, because I never thought of it that way, but I guess that's true. But two points in that. One is, like, right now, when I just was telling you a Ryan Holiday quote about book sales, that's implicit praise for him, because I'm quoting him.
Yep.
And I don't want to say it without saying this is what Ryan Holiday told me, because I don't want to unfairly take credit for what he said. So I had to praise him in order to convey this information to you.
Right. Yeah. And it's also like people say, oh, I'm going to steal this joke of yours, James. Or, I mean, you know, as a comic, that's a big no-no. But even like you steal someone's idea, that's considered theft. That's actually considered a damageable offense in the Talmud. So like, just the reason I think it'll be interesting is because people spend their whole life thinking about either, you know, what their image is on social media, or how much money they have, or, you know, are they going to get the next $600 stimulus check? But, you know, how often do they really? I think about it all the time, because it's weekly in Judaism. It's a ritual. Every Saturday, we have hours of discussion about the portion in the Torah. And it just takes you to this philosophical realm that most people don't have time for after freshman year of college.
And I think secularizing that by saying, hey,
yes,
if you like this, here's my newsletter where you're going to get this in this secular way.
Yes.
You don't have, nothing's going to mention God. By the way, you have to have a section about business and finance.
Here's the business section. So there's interest.
Oh, but the other thing I was going to mention though about the saying something good and then you have to pick up all the feathers. I obviously have seen an example of that these past few weeks where I wrote something I considered good, but once it's at, when you write something, once it's out of your hands, you have no control over the outcomes.
Yeah.
And some of the outcomes were so shitty. Was like unbelievable.
No, I know, like death threats and so forth.
Everything, like everything under the sun. And so I can see why, but then you, at some point though, there's gotta be, you have to be able to say things that are good. You have to be able to praise people who are good and say, hey, you should call this plumber instead of this plumber.
Yeah. But there is even like, there's a website that's, so, you know, like the Shabbos to an Orthodox Jew is very, like, you don't drive, you can't use a phone, you can't go to a restaurant. So there are actually an Orthodox person thought he was doing something really good. He set up a website where people, it was like Airbnb, but it was for Orthodox Shomer Shabbos people around the world. So I'm in Pensacola, Florida, you know, in January. Actually, I am supposed to be there. You know, where can I go if I have to stay over Saturday night? That, you know, the food is good, you know, and the hospitality is nice. So he set up this thing thinking it was a mitzvah, but it turned out to be like a really big sin and a very, you know, because he was basically encumbering people. He was telling, you know, Lashon Hara, he was like basically praising them too much. That could only invite negative. Like you said, the food was good. Like that brisket sucked ass. Like I'm, you know, like, and then it was, people were commenting on it. Like, oh, I'll never go to that person again. They got, yeah. So it's like, even the best intentions can cause, can negatively come back to haunt the unintended.
But if you take that to an extreme though, then you can't ever do anything good.
No, that's true. Of course it has to be in moderation, but you have to look at the amplification effect, the leverage effect, the network effect. And in some sense, you know, I think, yeah, of course you should, but it's really like some people on Yom Kippur, they don't talk at all. Like they actually are in silence for fear that they might say something like this that is, you know, potentially coming back to haunt them or, you know, to hurt them or whatever. So I think, well, it might be fun to talk about that on Yom Kippur, or not on Yom Kippur, but come back and discuss it. But yeah, the business stuff is like, you know, actually the hardest thing in the Torah is to maintain honest business practices, because it's the kind of thing like there's a concept.
Because it's all for Jews? No, I'm just kidding.
There's a concept like don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind, right? That's a famous law in the Torah, but what it means and how you apply that stuff, like who puts a block in front of a blind person? But of course it's a metaphor, right? It's like, don't do something when no one will find out but you. In other words, like a blind person doesn't know that there's a stumbling block in front of them. You know, they won't know until it's too late, but you knew when you did it. Or, you know, don't be mean to the, you know, don't hate the, a rich person in judgment. Like nowadays we have the social justice. That's completely anathema to Judaism. You're not supposed to favor. In fact, you're supposed to say, it says, don't favor the orphan or the widow in judgment. Oh, she's so poor. I feel so bad for her. You know, George Floyd's, you know, wife or whatever. Like, I feel so bad. I'm not talking about the actual case, but you know, whatever. I feel so bad for her. I don't even know if he's married, but now I'm going to give her the settlement, even though I don't know if I believe that he was actually in the, you know, whatever. So it's all things that you wouldn't know that the other counterparty wouldn't know. But the concept is that God knows everything. Like he knows you put the stumbling block in front of the poor person, or he knows that you hate your enemy so much, you're not going to help him when his donkey breaks down. You know, and that'll be another law, you know, like when you see your neighbor donkey straining, like it's not your neighbor straining, it's his donkey straining, but you're supposed to help the donkey. And even in that way, in that sense, you're actually adhering to laws of society. That case is societal law. In business, there's like things like if you can, let's say you're in the Holocaust, but you can get your kid saved. You can bribe the SS officer. Is it legal to do that? Like, do you think that something the Torah would look upon favorably?
So here's how I would answer that.
Yeah.
I would say absolutely yes, but then also my son would have to decide if it was legal for him to accept getting out that way.
There are certain things like that, but the majority rule is that you shouldn't, but that doesn't mean it's right. So for example, if you get a news report, you know, Boca Raton Drive or wherever you are, you know, is on fire and there's a house on fire and it's got a big swimming pool or whatever, there's five bedrooms or whatever, it's on fire. Are you allowed to like pray that it's not your house? Keep in mind that they thought prayer actually worked.
Well, that I would say no.
Because what does it mean?
Well, I would say because you're implicitly praying that it's someone
exactly.
else's house who might die.
Exactly. Right. That's 100% right. But in the SS thing too, right? Because the guy's going to kill somebody. He's got to kill somebody. So by you saving your son, you're actually committing someone else's son who doesn't have the money to
But him. I'm not hoping. I'm not relying on chance right. in that case. I'm taking action right. to save my son. Whereas I wouldn't take action to, I wouldn't randomly pick.
Right.
Right? Because I'm, you know, I let's say responsibility goes in concentric circles. So mm-hmm. there's family, then community, right. then... you know, religious or belief, you know, belief. And, mm-hmm. But there was something in there. I'm going to forget now. Have you ever read, there's a book, The Diamond Cutter, and it's an interpretation, like a Western interpretation of the Diamond Sutra in Buddhism. Mm. And some of these principles that you've spoken about also are in there.
Oh, interesting.
So the idea that you shouldn't, he uses, it's interesting because this, not a llama, but like something the right level right below a llama. He's in the diamond industry in New York, but he's also a Buddhist, and he writes this book and applies the Diamond Sutra to business. And he says something similar, which is that never gossip about anybody if you want to succeed in the workplace.
Interesting.
So like, or if you're having problems with workers, then immediately stop gossiping. So it's these things that seem disconnected, but he connects the dots using the Diamond Sutra the way you were using the Thomas.
Interesting.
So it's
just, that's nice because that'll help it be more secular or more applicable to more yeah. people. Than right. So yeah, the title, I'm still not really sure about how I want to do it. But the basic thing is like the end will be that there's no new thing under the sun, which is of course from the Book of Ecclesiastes, written allegedly by King Solomon also. But, you know, like, how do you think about these things? Like, it's better when I go flying, I'm a pilot, I have my own plane. You know, when I go flying, it's better to have a plan, even if it's a shit plan, than have no plan, like make it up in the air, you know, because it's better to be wishing you were on the, you know, in the air than when you're on the ground, than wishing you were on the ground when you're in the air. And like the Checklist Manifesto, I didn't really like that book so much. I thought it was very kind of poorly organized. But thinking of a checklist for your ethical life, that's no one's ever done that before, like an ethical checklist. Because in the heat of the moment, you're going to be screwed. Like they're bribing this SS office. Like
right, the idea too of having a plan so that you're not going to be caught off guard in a new situation. And even if you don't have a plan for this exact situation, you've exercised that muscle
yes.
enough that you can come up with a plan quickly. It's like in chess, it's not as high stakes as flying, but
right.
there's a saying, even a bad plan is better than no plan.
Yeah. Exactly.
So,
yeah. So having some kind of structure, it doesn't mean you have to believe in God. You don't. It doesn't mean, yeah. So I think, yeah, the Checklist Manifesto, but a moral version of it, just so that not, it's almost meta, like you just said, it's better to have a plan. So like, here's your ethical plan. At least start thinking about it, exercise the muscle, as you say. Yeah. I think that's a brilliant way to put it. So I think it could be a good, and it's sort of like my friend and I are just like writing, we're just putting a ton of crap down, but maybe what I'll do, I'll send you the outline maybe tomorrow just to look at it. Again, I'm going to have big people like Ben Shapiro, who's coming on my podcast next week. I probably have,
oh, that'll be fun.
Yeah, I probably have like, so you'd write the foreword. I might have Dennis Prager, who's a super popular guy, write the afterword because he writes this book called The Rational Bible, which is another book idea. So I have a book, James. Did you know?
Right, well, I have to tell you first
yeah.
my idea.
Yeah, yeah.
So I keep thinking of an idea called The Book.
Okay.
It's just called that. And I basically take 10 to 20 concepts that are universally in every religion,
uh-huh.
like do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's
yep.
in every
yep.
religion, the golden rule.
Yep.
And basically I would find these 10 to 20 things and describe how they're in every religion and how in practice, you know, some interesting things about that quote, like particularly in that one, for instance, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Most people think of the first part, but never the second part.
Right.
So meaning, people always assume that means be nice to others.
Right.
because of course you're going to be nice to yourself. But the reality is most people aren't very nice to themselves. It's also, it's important to put just as much work into the, as you would do unto yourself.
That's really
as the do unto others. And
actually
nobody ever
that.
Thinks that.
Yeah. It's actually true. In the Talmud, like it says things, different levels. Like, it says, yeah, like you said, you shouldn't, love thy neighbor basically. And then it says, but like, two brothers were fighting and you're like, what the hell does that have to do with anything? But it's like, if you, and there's actually a word for it or a phrase for it in Hebrew, it's kol v'chomer, like all the more so, a fortiori is where we translate it in modern Latin or whatever. But like, if you are obligated to your neighbor who's not related to you, all the more so you're obligated to your brother or your wife. So you're having a fight with your wife and you're not going to stop until you win the fight. You're actually violating a commandment not to hate your neighbor. Even you're like, what the hell? My wife's not my neighbor. She's my wife and she lives under my roof. But no, if your wife is also an other. And so you owe this to her. But then the ultimate is what you just said. You owe it to yourself to give yourself that love, that benefit. Exactly as you're saying. That's in the Talmud.
Right. And you know, when I wrote Choose Yourself and I had that title, not a lot of people, but you know, enough that I noticed were critical. Mm. Oh, that sounds really selfish. But you know, it's the whole metaphor of you put the mask on yourself before your baby. Mm. If you're in a plane and their oxygen masks fall down, you've got to take care of yourself in every possible way in order to best help others. Mm-hmm. In order to contribute the most good to the world, you have to focus on yourself the most.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I feel like with the ethical will. If you write your ethical will, you're not going to be as likely to commit suicide because you're going to be thinking about you're taking care of yourself, you're valuing yourself, you're tallying up yourself, maybe you're forgiving yourself, and maybe you're seeing a perspective that, yeah, I felt like killing myself when I was 19 also, but I don't, you know, and now I'm 49, almost 49, you know, now I felt like killing myself, you know, whatever. You know, maybe it'll give you that perspective that, no, there's something, you know, independent of it.
Just on that real quickly, because now, because that was the one also you were thinking self-publishing, real publishing.
Yeah.
This one could be a short book also.
The book and you one? Get, you mean you're one of the books?
The Ethical Will.
Oh, yeah. Book. Okay, yeah. How so?
So you don't have, like, short books are more easy, they're easier to self-publish, mm-hmm. and you still get all the benefits you want to get, which is email list, more subscribers, you know.
Back catalog.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So kind of a semi quasi business or at least a trafficked website around it.
The thing I wonder about with that is how do I get permission? That's why I want to talk to Tim and to what's his name? The Tucker Max, you know, like how do we go through the permit? Like I want to get, well, first of all, some of the people like Freeman Dyson is dead. But I have this hour, 2 hour, 3 hour interview with him that's gold that he never, you know, I go deep with my guests. I don't just talk about, why are you so brilliant? And, you know, tell me about Dyson spheres. No, I go like, what is the meaning of your life when you look back on it? Can you teach someone to be creative? Or is it just, you know, platitude that everybody's got? You know, so I've got all that. It's on tape. But like, what's the legality? Or Jim Simons, like, do I really want to like publish something in a book? He's already said it on the podcast on YouTube, you know, 50,000 people.
Yeah,
saw
yeah.
It.
That's all fair game.
I can like transcribe it or do I need their permission? Yeah. Do I need them to sign something like did Tim?
No.
I thought what Tim did is he says like, I didn't use the transcript because there's all the ums and ahs and like dead end questions that go nowhere, which you know, obviously I do that a lot, but well, what do you think?
Yeah, I did this. So I wrote a book called Think Like a Billionaire mm-hmm. and I actually published it in a very different way. It was an experiment for me. I published it just on script, which is kind of like a Netflix for books.
Okay.
There's millions of books and there's millions of subscribers. And so it was just script subscribers who could read this book. And now, you know, 6 months later or a year later, I'll publish it on Amazon. But it's just it's the transcripts of every billionaire I've interviewed, mm-hmm. plus my comments and what I learned. And I edited the transcripts, take out the ums and the ahs and clean it up. And then for the audiobook, I read my parts out loud, but then just put the podcast episodes in for the audiobook.
Oh, interesting. Oh, that's smart.
So I have a paperback, ebook and audiobook for it.
Oh, that's awesome. I got to get that one. I've seen it, but it's not on Amazon, right? Oh, the audiobook is on Audible, right?
No, it was just on script.
Oh, it's only on script, the whole thing. Okay.
Yeah. And then I mean, at some point I'll do it for all, but I just haven't had.
So I feel like the Bible book that, I mean, the book that you just mentioned, like if I had that idea, I wouldn't feel bad about taking that to Tucker and just like paying him to write the whole book. Like, I know he's got that service to do the whole thing, because it's not like it's a great idea, but it's not like, oh, my kids, when they find out that I didn't, you know, I have to keep that hidden from them or whatever. You know, but with,
why?
With, the, I'm just saying, like, I don't know, there's a stigma against like using ghostwriters or whatever. I'm saying, like, I wouldn't feel bad about that book.
Why would you use a ghostwriter though?
Just the time. Like, I just don't have time. Like
but would you outline all the ideas and pick the quotes and stuff like that? Okay.
Yeah. I would curate it, for sure. Like, I think the Ethical Will book and the Talmud book, because I have a co-writer and he's going to do a good job, you know, so I don't need Tucker or whatever. And I'll do my chapters. He's got his 10, his 9 chapters. I do mine. We got 18 ideas. Boom. But in terms of the Ethical Will book, I feel like that is so close to my heart. Like, I wouldn't feel good, even though I don't have the time for it. So I'm just worried, like, oh, I don't know. Is there a self-stigma, not about self-publishing versus traditional, but about like leveraging someone like a Tucker to do that. Like the book that you just mentioned, the book, that would be perfect. You had the idea, you just hand it off because you want to get it done. You've got to, and that liberates your time, leverages you to do the other 10 books that you're working on. Whereas it's not like you're going to feel like, oh, you'd rather have it be out there than have it be 100% James.
Yeah. Well, think about it. Like there's various stages, right? So remove all stigmas for a second and let's just analyze this structurally. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you said, oh, hey, write a mystery novel for me and then I'm going to put my name on it and you give it to a ghostwriter who's great at mystery novels and you put it out there and your name's good enough to make sales because let's say you have a platform and blah. So that's one level where it's like useless.
I actually have an idea for that because I'm not a good writer in terms of fiction, but I think a great murder mystery, you know, that only 3 people can win the Nobel Prize, right?
On any one prize?
Only the Peace Prize can more than 3 people win it. Yeah, they just arbitrarily changed it. Okay. So, and a lot of people know that, but I guess not you, but that's fine. But you had a murder mystery where like 3 people discover, you know, like how to cure cancer. And they're 4 people discover how to cure cancer, and then like one of them murders the other one, but we don't know.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. So like, but I don't want to write it. Like, but I think
it's like the Highlander, but with the Nobel Prize.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Whoever's the last one standing.
That's right. There can be only one. There could be only 3. Yeah. That could be the title. There can be only 3. But I would farm that out in a second, you know. But yeah, but then and then I just edit it, I guess. I mean, how much does that cost to do that? Because I don't care about like that's not a prestige thing. That's just like there's a funny idea.
No, what I would do there is I would outline it out as much as you can, and then finish the outline with a ghostwriter who's written successful thrillers before, mm-hmm. and then then it's perfectly fine to be Brian Keating with so and so, or just you use the ghostwriter. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Okay,
like that's. So that's a business model,
okay.
Right? Yep. That's fine. And then the other thing is, but this applies to what you just said too, particularly with that link. You're also a producer.
Yeah.
So like, let's say if this idea I have, the book, let's say, let me put it a slightly different way. I come up with all the quotes and then I outsource each chapter to a different person I think would be a specialist in that quote. Then it's clear that I'm building a production and although I might not do a single writing of a single word, it's my production. It's mm-hmm. still by me with help from this whole list of prestigious authors. So no, one step away from that is one author and you with all the ideas, and then you do the final edit. So mm-hmm. the last word is by you. And is that any different, really? You're still a producer.
Right.
You're the producer of the book. So that entitles you to have your name on the front.
Yeah, it was my idea, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah.
And so, and then the final thing would be is, I mean, also look at it completely, like what, like take almost any Hemingway book. Did Hemingway write the book or did Max Perkins write the book?
His editor, right?
So if you look at the first drafts that Hemingway did and then Max Perkins edits, it's almost a different book.
Yeah.
Like he rewrote paragraphs, chapters, whatever. Like he was like the best editor of all time. But it really is still Hemingway's book as the writer and Max Perkins the editor. Just we feel this need to put labels on, but it's a creative project that mostly Hemingway did. Max Perkins added a lot. Mm-hmm. Other people probably added to it, and it became the book it did.
Mm-hmm. So, Jay, can you stop just what we've been talking about for the last hour or so, and then save that?
But this is a good podcast. This is a Joe Rogan style podcast. let's include this part, just this one thing, in as the conclusion of the podcast we're doing. So it's kind of like a teaser, okay, a little bit.
Okay, great. Yeah.
So just to set the stage, inflation is this theory which occurs in the Big Bang, like after that initial unknown mysterious explosion from supposedly a singularity, for a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second, all these things are happening called inflation, which basically sets up almost like the quote unquote DNA of the universe to come.
Yeah.
And, but there's a lot of unknowns all around that. But you just said something really interesting, which is, of course, inflation applies a multiverse. I don't understand that. Why does inflation imply a multiverse?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Imagine, do you know about people making sourdough and there was like the shortage of yeast because of the pandemic? You couldn't buy yeast for a long time. And so people turned to a more primitive form of making an agent that causes rising of dough. And that's called sourdough, where you basically take some mush, give it, some food that bacteria like to eat, and then they'll find it. You just put it out in the woods or you put it on your windowsill, and eventually in the air, there'll just be some yeast. And the yeast, because it was so hard to find yeast and for a long time, the yeast will come to it and you'll get the sourdough mash, I think it's called. I don't know if this is ringing a bell or whatever, but what would be the probability? So that yeast, let's say one yeast, what do you call them? One yeast animal, whatever you call it, lands on a petri dish. Let's just say you have a bowl and you put some sugar and some water. It's called a petri dish. And then what's the probability that only one of those forms? If you know in the future, there's a whole big loaf of bread, like how probable is it that there'd be just one yeast organism?
So I would say like trillion to one, but you could,
yeah,
but this is going to lead into, in another episode, the digital simulation stuff, which, one could argue strongly against, even though the odds, when you put it that way, are like also like a quintillion to one.
Right. Right. So the problem is estimating the posterior probability when you don't have enough of a prior. So you don't have prior information. You know that like there are a lot of taxi cabs in New York City, or there were before it died forever, that are yellow, but not all taxis are yellow. Right. So you have some prior information. You say, I know there was an accident involved a taxi. If you say if you say it was a yellow car, that's much higher likelihood that it was a taxi than any other type of car, right?
Right.
But the converse of it being like a black car, there are still taxis that are black, but the overwhelming prior information informs the estimate that you ultimately come up with, your posterior estimate. So in the case of inflation, the only way to get a large enough value of the posterior proposition that we exist, coming from something that is so improbable, is to increase the prior probability. And the best way, the largest number you can think of for a prior probability, in other words, the fraction of possible universes there could have been at the earliest times in history, is to make that infinite, to have an infinite number of possible universes, of which ours is just one, and it has the right properties for us to exist. And that's this anthropic principle that says that the only way to have a universe that has observers asking the question of whether or not there are universes that can exist is if it has the conditions that it has. And those are, sometimes used to make what are so-called fine-tuned versions of this argument. But the basic notion is inflation doesn't tell you how it got started. It doesn't tell you its own origin. It needs something else to tell you what its origin is. Now, of course, you're going to ask me, what's the origin of whatever the multiverse is? And that's where people start to get these infinite kind of regressive questions. But the question of the multiverse's existence, at least it's well posed, even if it's not well motivated by any evidence that we have currently, in that our existence suggests that that there's something that could have happened in the early universe that's not inconsistent with inflation, which means that you had to have something like the multiverse.
Right, or there could just be, next to one Big Bang, another Big Bang that would happen, and next to that,
exactly,
another Big Bang.
So in my book, I use that analogy. I say actually a petri dish with one culture of bacteria could be, just outside the horizon of how fast these things can travel on their whatever flagella, I don't know. But anyway, it could be far enough away that they don't know about the existence of another culture for sure. But the fact that they exist proves that there's material in the meta, you know, kind of space of all possible points in space and time. There are conditions that are propitious enough that they can exist. Therefore, it's not impossible that another culture could exist. And if the petri dish is big enough, there could be an infinite number of them, of cultures and cultures and cultures beyond.
But I feel like, though, this is one of those things where you have to prove it to say it.
Yeah,
really.
So there,
like,
are, right. So there,
because
are,
the simplest solution really is just that there's one universe, because that's what we observe, and there was one Big Bang, and you even keep the rules of relativity if it was a big bounce. So there was just contraction, expansion, contraction, expansion over and over again. So, but then you're getting to multiple infinite universes again as well. But does that count?
Right. So the question of whether or not there's any reason to believe in the multiverse is a very good one. And of course, you'd like to have there be evidence, right? So if I say there are other planets outside the solar system, until 1992 or so, 1993 or four, actually, we didn't know if there were other planets outside of our solar system. We could derive that there should be other planets because there are other stars. Other stars came from previous generation of stars that blew up. And the material that goes into a star right before it blows up is exactly the type of composition the Earth is made up of, right? So you could say that there's millions, literally billions, maybe a trillion other stars in our galaxy or in surrounding galaxies. And so, of course, there's a very high likelihood. But did you know it? I suspect that question didn't trouble you. You just assumed it. And many physicists just assume that there is a multiverse.
Right. So there's a difference between like deduction and induction. So deduction, you might have one set of clues and you can deduce something. But induction is like, oh, there's a bunch of examples, so I'm going to induce that this goes on forever, which right. It probably does in the case of, it's easy for me to induce that there's more planets all over right. The place, even
it's,
if we
it's
can't
almost
see
like
them.
The other way around. You're absolutely right. So it's almost like saying, in the to make the analogy for us, it would be like saying there must be other planets because we exist. But that's not exactly that's not the logic that we apply. We say there must be other planets because we exist. They're, not that we exist because there are other planets.
Right. So I would say, though, let's say me not knowing anything, and I'm curious what you'll think. If someone said to me, why is there a multiverse? I would think of three things. One's philosophical. The other two are things you've observed in the lab. So the philosophical one is that, in general, every cosmological improvement over history has involved humans being less and less the center of things. So if you take that one more step further, this can't be the only universe. There's plenty of universes where there's no life at all. There's plenty of universes where there's just life is made out of, I don't know, steel or whatever, or elements that never occurred here or whatever. So that's the philosophical first principle that I'm going off of. But then, and then the two other things is, one is there's this phenomena that sometimes electrons and photons and neutrons just appear out of nowhere, right, in the universe. Mm-hmm. So they have to be appearing, you would think they have to be appearing from somewhere. So then I would assume they're kind of visiting. They're massless enough that they're visiting from some other universe and going in between whatever fabric exists between universes in the multiverse.
What's your third one? The first one I agree with you on, I actually talk about that in my book. I call those great debates. So it's starting with Copernicus and Galileo, that we're not the center of our own solar system, then that the solar system's not the center of the galaxy, the galaxy's not the center of the observable universe. Now, is our universe the center of the multiverse? That's the next step in these Copernican debates.
Right.
Second thing about virtual particles popping in and out of the vacuum is something that we observe currently in the lab. We can actually observe the effects of these things. We can't actually, you know, summon a particle out of the vacuum from two antiparticles, but we the calculations, the properties of particles that we detect when we smash things together are only self-consistent with their mathematical behavior if there exists a vacuum, a state of zero energy, ground state, from which things can pop into it and out of existence as long as they maintain the symmetry that existed beforehand. In other words, you get equal amounts of positive charge as negative charge, and you get equal, and you have an equal, you know, sort of opposite mass energy condition that's observed as well.
Right, but how does that not contribute to the multiverse idea? Because here's my ultimate point with that is that, again, given trillions and quadrillions of years in the multiverse, there's going to be some point where enough particles just appear out of nowhere, that it creates a singularity that then explodes. And that's how a Big Bang happens.
Yeah, well, so not all singularities explode. Like a black hole is thought to be a singularity. By the way, again, we don't know what it means to be a singularity because we have no notion of the physical ramifications of infinity. And a black hole would be, a singularity would truly be a point of infinite density, infinite temperature, or and so forth, potentially in the Big Bang context. But getting back to this question, again, because we can have what's called a vacuum state in our laboratory, we can actually experiment with these existence of the virtual particles without requiring a whole other universe. Now, you may be considering what we call the vacuum, the something from nothing, creation ex nihilo, but it's really not considered creation ex nihilo. It's sort of like an accounting, you know, trick. You can borrow as much money as you want as long as you return it before the bank notices it's missing, right? In some sense. You know, if you could go into infinitesimal amount of time, take out $1 trillion and put it back a trillionth of a second later, they can't possibly know that you took it. So the vacuum is kind of like that. You can borrow energy from the vacuum, create particles from the vacuum, as long as they have equal and opposite momenta, which is the amount of directional energy they carry, and they have equal and opposite charges. So you can't create net charge, and you can't create net momentum, but you can create net mass. Right? So that's kind of weird. You created mass from something that had no mass, namely the vacuum. That was something that was completely absent. And then all of a sudden mass pops into existence. And that is observed. And the consequences of that are observed without requiring a multiverse for it to take place. There are interpretations called Everettian quantum mechanics, many worlds interpretation, that do have a sense of a multiverse where every possible choice, every possible decision takes place in some universe or another, including whether or not we call this particle virtual or real. That can take place, and it takes place over such a short amount of time, we can't yet possibly measure it.
And we'll get to that theory in the fuller beginning of the universe series. So my third reason why there you could say in some observational way that there might be a multiverse is gravity. So gravity is this incredibly weak force, right? It's weaker than electromagnetism. It's weaker than the nuclear forces. So the idea is that it's spread out across the multiverse, whereas those, and you mentioned in an earlier episode how it has some properties similar to, you know, like it, you know, as gravity travels over space, it loses power to the inverse of whatever. Mm-hmm. But because gravity is so weak, perhaps it's spread out across the multiverse as opposed to these other forces are just inside this universe.
All right. Yeah. So that would be a parallel. So there's many different types of multiverses. So there could be a multiverse in space. That's physically a universe, just like our universe.
Right. Just next to us.
Next to us. Maybe it's one light year beyond our observable horizon, meaning next year we're going to bump into it in a sense. And people have made predictions. Latham Boyle and other scientists around the world have made calculations of what would be the observational imprint of our universe bouncing into another universe and creating an imprint, which would be the imprimatur of a multiverse. So that would be direct evidence for a multiverse. We haven't seen that yet, but that's one way you could have a multiverse. Another way you could have a multiverse is if there are these things called brains, which are sort of extra dimensions that we don't perceive the same way that from a long distance away, a piece of spaghetti looks like a one-dimensional line. But as you get closer to it, you can see it's two-dimensional. And when you get even closer to it, it can perceive it's three-dimensional. So that means the dimensionality gets compactified or gets shrunken down or reduced as you perceive it, depending on your distance away from it. Now, there are some that say that gravity can propagate between these different dimensions. So if we did live in a five-dimensional universe, there could be another dimension that we, let's say we lived in a four-dimensional universe. So that you could go left, right, up, down, backwards and forwards, and Blorkus and Blorkon. We don't have words for it, but there's actually a notion of it. It's called a tesseract. You can, just as a cube makes a square shadow when you put a flashlight on it from above, a cube looks square. And then a square, if you had a square and you shine light from the side on a checkerboard, that looks like a line. And then you take a line and shine a flashlight on it, that projects down to a point. So going the opposite direction, the shadow of a tesseract is what?
our current 3D cube.
A cube, yeah. It would exactly look like a cube. And so so imagine there's another dimension that projects things into our dimension that we perceive as these three-dimensional solids. But in their dimension, they can see everything, just like we could see characters on a chessboard, you know, from being above it, but they don't have a concept of what above it means. So there could be another dimension. And it could be that the three forces, the two forces of the nucleus, the strong and weak forces, and the force of electromagnetism are confined to those two planes, to the three-dimensional spatial world that we know and love. But the force of gravity can go between the two dimensional spaces. That can go between the fourth dimension of space and the third dimension of space. And that's called brain theory. Lisa Randall wrote a wonderful book about this called Warp Passages, about this particular idea. And some even conjecture that it could be responsible for what we perceive as dark matter, could be the effect of ordinary matter in this parallel universe of a higher dimensionality, and that it could be a millimeter away in some sense, just like we could put a cube above a chessboard by 1 millimeter, and the people talking along the chessboard can only hear themselves in the chessboard. They can't hear anything because that's sound. That's a chemical, you know, ultimately transmitted by molecules. But they could feel the force of gravity from a cube. And that's actually, you can actually show that. And the light can show two-dimensional systems are affected by gravity in the third dimension. So maybe, just maybe, we could do an experiment that would show there's a fourth dimension of space that is responsible for the gravitational effects of that galaxies are perceived to have due to what we call dark matter, but have been unable to detect. And the reason we can't detect it is because we can't go to the fourth dimension yet.
Wait, it's like right above us.
It could be a millimeter away in some abstract space. That's right.
Right. And same with dark energy, right? We don't know what's pulling.
Yeah, it could be. And so we try to do experiments because, you know, the day is short, you know, so to speak. The stakes are high. We want to do as much as we can. We try to do experiments with the tools that we have today. Unfortunately, when you talk about gravity, since it is so weak, the scales in which you have to carry out your experiments are galactic or bigger. It's very hard to do like a tabletop experiment of gravity. I mean, the original force, the gravitational force, when it was first observed, was observed in the lab to have this inverse square dependence by Cavendish, famous Cavendish experiment, which every physics major does at one point in his or her career. So you can do it on a tabletop, but that's about it. That's like besides a ball rolling down an inclined plane, which our friend Galileo used as a way to slow down the force of gravity so that it was commensurate with the technological tools available to him to measure time. Remember, Galileo was doing experiments before there was a watch. They were using like their pulse. They were using pendula. There was no reliable clock in 1632. Can you imagine like doing something like we're trying to figure out the multiverse, but we don't have a way to measure like distance or something? Like it's inconceivable how great an accomplishment that was. And yet all people learn about Galileo from these boring, oh, here's a ball rolling down a thing. What if I tell you, you know, like that was part of the reason he was put in jail and, you know, allegedly tortured? I think it would make science teaching much, much more interesting.
Because science gets a little more blurry.
Yeah, that's right.
So, but, the fact that gravity, which is completely different from these other forces, but still has this interesting mathematical property that's exactly the same, kind of shows that maybe that there's basic components to all of these things that are just exactly the same. And this is kind of like a tease of we're doing a several podcast episodes about the origins of the universe with Brian Keating, super physicist, almost Nobel laureate, losing the Nobel Prize is his book. And this episode's been a great episode of just riffing on a bunch of different ideas. So thanks once again, Brian, for this started off as just a pre-podcast conversation. It became the whole podcast. So thanks once again for coming on the podcast, and see you on your birthday to start doing again the Origins of the Universe podcast.
Getting back to work. That's right. Thank you, James. Have a great weekend.
All right. Thanks a lot, you guys.